bring it to my wife. My wife has
good. You want it here too?
Why? Great.
Good. This is you later.
Okay. Well, why? I can't know what you're saying. Okay, one second. Do me a favor, David, check that the tape is turning. Today is Monday, March 13th, 2006, and we're here on Tainit Esther, our weekly Shayur on Jewish history. Now, first of all, are the boys still davening? Because I see the classroom. They just finished 5 minutes ago. Wow, you say long slichas, and my shul, everyone said, I told them, Tainit Esther, you know why the slichas are so short, Tainit Esther? Because it's Erev Yontif. You don't say Tachnunet Mincha today already. So there is a minute that the slicha of Tainit Esther is shorter than usual slicha. Tomorrow, no, we don't say Alanisim, but the rest of Eretz Yisrael says Alanisim outside of... there are places where there's a suffix outside Yerushalayim, but I wonder in Tzfat what they do. Tzfat, Akko, these Lud, these are the cities that are suffix. Halach Lamaisa, I believe they observed Yudalit, but look, with Yerushalayim too, you should know that there were tremendous machlokot here. When Beit Vegan was established, most of Beit Vegan observed Yudalit. When Beit Vegan was established, there was no continuity. And do you see the Harabayat from Baitram? Do you see the old city? And then when Ramat was established, I remember the tremendous machloket at that time. I was living here. And today, all these areas observe, as far as I know. I know in Beit Vegan, there's Rav Steinbach, if I'm not mistaken. He taka, I don't know if he makes a bracha, but I know that he observes Yud Dalet, that there's a Megillah reading there. If you have to travel to America... On Purim, and you live in Yerushalayim, you may go to Beit Vegan, they hit a Megillah reading in Rav Steinbach's shul. So in Ramat too, there must be places that observe Yudalit. But today there's continuity, so it's a lot easier to say it's Tetvav. Okay, anyway, coming to Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, there's no question that the man was a master of language. There was one epigram I left out, which is maybe the most famous one. Rabbi Yisrael used to say, Im kol hashana kula, who ke'elel, oz chol deshelel, hu elel. And you know, if all year you act as if it's chol deshelel, then chol deshelel is really chol deshelel. And you know what that means? I can still remember in Bnei Akiva going back on to 55 years ago, if not more. But I still remember that we would be, you know, Bnei Akiva, boys and girls, the Bronx, and suddenly it's time to daven Mincha Shabbos. And I remember someone remarking to me, how do you go from boys and girls, Musa, then suddenly what's amazing is all these ideas have come to pass. And when you think in terms of the Steinsaltz Gemara, the Art Scroll Gemara, or you think in terms of Jastro, you think in terms of all the books that are out, I mean, it's a genre of literature unto itself today. I mean, you walk into Eichler's in Brooklyn and in Flatbush or in Borough Park, You can't believe all that's available for teenagers, for kids growing up to read. Now, you raised a different question. Does this mean that we don't read the classics? As a YU person, I say absolutely not. Classics remain classics. I don't want to... With all due respect to Marcus Lehmann, Rabbi Dr. Marcus Lehmann of Germany, who was the first one to write novels for teenagers that have been translated into English, by the way, I still don't feel he equals some of the classic literature. So we need both, but Rabbi Yisrael's insight was very good because children can relate to literature. And if your heroes are Shomrei Shabbos and Moshe Nefesh for Yiddishkeit, it leaves an impact on a kid growing up in the Big Gola. In Israel, here too there have been breakthroughs, you understand. There's now a novelist from Bnei Brak who has written novels in contemporary life. Some of them have become bestsellers in Israel. And the guy writes, you know, from a Haredi point of view, instead of putting down religious people, he uplifts them. Same thing in America. You have some serious novelists, Kanayin Hara, graduates of Stern College, graduates of Yeshiva College, and their novels bring respect to religion. You have today Naomi Reagan, where, of course, people are divided. But you have to know Naomi's Reagan's background to appreciate Naomi Reagan. No, I always say about Naomi Reagan, Baruch Hashem, she remained from, she was a very talented young lady who winds up in Beis Yaakov in Borough Park. And if you know what that means for these girls with minds that think to remain frum after being in Beis Yaakov, you got to give them all the credit. So she bears a certain grudge against Beis Yaakov, which I understand. It comes out in her novels. It's that type of world. On the other hand, she's very solid, 100%. I can tell you in America, I met a young lady who's she's a heart surgeon specialist. In other words, her specialty within cardiology is pacemakers and defibrillators and that part of medicine. And I don't have to tell you how important that is today. Every day they do implants and save lives. So I was curious as to her background. She told me her background. She was in Beis Yaakov in Los Angeles. And that's where she grew up. And she was going out of her mind with the narrow-mindedness. And when she was a junior in high school, her uncle was head of the cardiology department at the UCLA Medical School. So already when she was a junior in high school, she started doing research in cardiology. And Beis Yaakov didn't like that. She wound up not graduating, got into UCLA without a high school degree, or, you know, the early admissions, whatever they call it, because she was so bright. Then her grandmother was worried stiff she'll go to UCLA, she won't remain frum. And she went into Stern College, once again didn't graduate, went into Albert Einstein at the end of 3 years. So that's novels, and you have to understand the person, where they're coming from, and what they've achieved in life, and color kavod to that woman. Okay, and that's Rabbi Yisrael, and I told you the stories with the rabbinical delegation on the east side. I told you about Shankar with Chaim Shmulevich, and this is what we call in Musa, there's a Yiddish word they use, a darher. I don't know how to translate that into English. I don't know how to translate it into Hebrew. But what it means is a person has to see beyond, has to have a certain spiritual feeling that he can feel something beyond the reality. You know, you just see a push cart on Shabbos. But if Mehata Musa Daher, you see Chilul Shabbos of the most of flagrant nature right in front of your eyes. And it hurts. And the same thing with dead bodies of Chinese coolies. It's an affront to the Tzelem Elokim. Now, Reb Yisrael would have been gone and forgotten, and it would have been an interesting topic. There are many revolutionary people who had great ideas in the history of Torah, but if you don't raise students, it dies with you. Because the masses are not on the level to comprehend what the Rebbe wanted, what the Rebbe understood. But Reb Yisrael raised three great students, and I told you, one he called the Chacham Reb Simcha Zissel Breida, one he called the Chassid Reb Naftali Amsterdam, and the one we'll begin with, the eldest among them, and the greatest Lamdan among them, was Reb Yitzchak Plaza. Now, as I said last week, he's also known as Reb Itzel Peterburger, and you'll understand why in a few minutes. Now, his years, to put him into context, 1837-1907. He was born in a Vilna suburb, Schnippischnuck. I happened to be in Schnippischnuck when I visited Vilna. The hotel was located there, and it really exists. And you see signs, because when we grew up, our rabban used to speak of Schnippischnuck with such reverence, and we thought they were joking. Who could have a place named Schnippischnuck? When I got to Vilna, I saw signs, this way, the Schnippischnuck. He grew up, obviously he didn't study with Reb Yisrael in Vilna because he was too young, but he studied with Reb Yisrael in Kovna. He already studied with Reb Yisrael when the Muslim movement reached its maturity under Reb Yisrael, when it took on the cloys and pulling away from general society at times, being reticent, humble, Musa, fear of death, melancholia. He saw that in Kovna. He was a tremendous Lamdan, but being a Musanik, he did not wish to make a living out of his Torah. As Pirkei Avot puts it, you should not make the Torah a kadam lach pobo. And I don't have to tell you how much has been written, how many tshuvot, you have the Tashbetz, you have the Rambam, the Perush of Pirkei Avot, how much has been written about making a living out of teaching Torah or being a rabbi. And this is a halachic problem. It's not for us to go into now, but you will recognize the problem. A Musanik didn't want to make a living out of Torah. His family were house painters. He wanted to become a house painter. And he actually spent time painting homes. He was a painter, tzabah, what we call in Hebrew. It's a very honorable profession. You paint walls. In Israel, it's mamash mitzvah, it's binyan haaretz. And that way, you're learning and Yirat Shemayim has nothing to do with the way you make a living. Reb Yisrael insisted that he had to go into the rabbinate. And in 1862, he became the Rav of St. Petersburg. Now, St. Petersburg was a very important city. It was a very important rabbinate in Russia. For one simple reason. The heart of the Russian government was in two places, Moscow and St. Petersburg. Generally, the Tsars spent most of the year in St. Petersburg and part of the summer in Moscow. St. Petersburg is a little bit warmer than Moscow. It's on the river, and therefore it's a little bit warmer. And that was where they built, those of you that have visited St. Petersburg, it is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It remains a beautiful city until today. The winter palace of the Tsar is there because he spent the winter and part of the spring and part of the fall. That was one of the main seats of power. Now, the Rebbe of St. Petersburg, not only was there a large Jewish community there, but this was a very important position because Shtadlanut. In the 1800s, you were constantly dealing with the Tsar, you were dealing with his commissions, commissions on education, commissions on religion. You constantly had to deal with the Tsar. St. Petersburg was perhaps the most preeminent rabbinical position in this part of Russia at that time. And that's how Reb Itzala, Yitzchak in Yiddish, the diminutive form is Itzala, and that's how he became known as Reb Itzala Peterburger, because for many years he was the Rav of St. Petersburg. Now, because St. Petersburg was Karav Lamalchut, because that was the capital city, it was not only a center for religious Jews, but it was a center for enlightenment. The Maskilim lived there. This is where Jews could live. This is where Jews could go to school. This is where Jews could become part of Russian civilization. This is what we spoke about, Russification. This is where the Tsar and the Maskilim worked hand in hand to Russify the Jew, to enlighten the Jew, to broaden the Jew, to bring him in to this beautiful civilization of the contemporary world. Now, what went on in St. Petersburg? And here you come to this reverberates, and it's a picture that captures an era. In St. Petersburg, one of the most important maskilim authors, writers lived there, Yalag, Yehuda Leib Gorton. Yehuda Leib Gordon wrote in Matan Hebrew, and he wrote poetry, and he wrote essays, and he's the person who coined the one line that became so famous, Hevi Yehudi beveitecha v'adam b'tzeyatecha. And what this means, that Judaism, it's the modern world. What does the modern world mean? Religion is a personal matter. When you walk out of your house, you leave religion at home, you become a member of the greater Russian society. Now, isn't that the United States? Just think for a minute. I mean, I don't want to put Yalak down. I don't want to put Yehuda Leib Gordon down, because look what we're like in the United States. We go to Davin, for instance, know that one of my students, it may or may not be true, but he did not get the head of a department, and people whisper behind his back that the reason he didn't get the head of the department is because he wears the yarmulke. And they didn't want that image, that the head of one of the big departments in Columbia Presbyterian is a guy who wears although it's a black knitted yarmulke, that if you don't look twice, you don't see it. You think it's his hair. But don't we live like that? So I don't want to say I disagree with Yalak. There's something to think about here. Rav Hirsch used to talk about the universal man and the human being and the Jew, and the Rav speaks there, but now take a look. When Yalag would meet Rav Blaza, the chief rabbi of St. Petersburg, the dominant religious figure, it was worlds in conflict. And we have descriptions of this. Why? Because now let's look at the Yitzchak Blaza. He was tall. He was about 6'2". We have live descriptions of him. Jews were not that tall at that time. Today I face eight grandchildren that are taller than I am, But at that time, Jews were not that tall. People were not that tall in general. And Jews certainly were not that tall. And he was tall. He was gaunt. He was a Musenik. He had a beard, and he dressed in black. And when he walked in the streets, he walked with his eyes down. You understand why did he walk with his eyes down? It's very simple. Some of the sights you see in the street, you can't look at, plain and simple. If you're in Tel Aviv during the summer, you got to walk with your eyes down. If you're in New York during the summer, Ribbono Shel Olam, I don't want to go into detail, but we're living in a world where people walk around half naked when the sun comes out. So he walked with his eyes down. Now, a maskil, how did a maskil walk? With his eyes forward, he's part of the world, he's proud, he's not ashamed, he's a mensch, he's not only a Jew, but he's a universal man, he's a humanistic man, he's part of civilization. There's no difference in the public thoroughfare between a Jew and a Russian Orthodox and a Protestant, etc. In America, no different, Catholic, a Protestant, Mohammedan, Jewish, we're all Americans, isn't this the ideal? Suddenly he would bunk into Rav Yitzchak Laza, and he would be ashamed, and it was worlds in conflict. He's going, Rav Yitzchak Laza, gate mit panim lamata, he's looking down, and he looks unworldly, and he's pale, and he's skinny, and he doesn't partake of the pleasures, and it was head-on conflict. It was not just with Yalag. I only use Yalag as the example because all the memoir literature records how unhappy their meetings were. But it was the maskil versus the traditional Jew. And Reb Yitzchak Blaza suffered. And you'll see how this affects his life. But now I want to tell you the classic story, a story you'll never forget. I heard this from the Rav, and you can read about it. And I actually Xeroxed in front of me the relevant text, but the story is as follows. Remember, I told you that St. Petersburg was Kerev Lamalchut. Now, the Russian government during this period, the 1850s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, was constantly interfering with the Jewish world because they wanted to Russify the Jewish world. Remember what we spoke about for Russia. As a matter of fact, until we uncovered the recent documents, everyone believed that Russia closed down, that the Tsarist government closed down for Russia because they wouldn't introduce Russification. It turns out it's not totally correct, only partially. But there would be constant meetings in St. Petersburg to meet with the Tsar, to meet with his people. Who hosted them? Reb Yitzchak Blaza. It would be in his shul, in his study. He would host them. They would come. They would discuss. They would debate. They would decide what to do. So then there's the famous story. The Beit HaLevi B'Chvodo V'Atzmo, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, for whom my Rebbe has named his great-grandfather, along with the other Gedolei Yisrael, come to St. Petersburg. They have to be Mitcha'etz. They have to sit together, Utsa Eitza, come up with an idea. They're meeting with the Tsarist people. They're going to send a delegation. What they should say, what they should request, how to handle it. And then they finish what we'll call the political aspect of the visit. And they're sitting around in Reb Yitzchak Plaza's study, and they say, all right, we're finished. Yes, stop me reading and learning. Now we got to talk and learning. And they get involved with a very fascinating topic. How many of you know about the White Knights of Leningrad? How many of you know the White Knights of St. Petersburg? We don't even know what I'm talking about. There are times in the year where there's basically no night whatsoever. You mamish, Shabbos ends like midnight, Saturday night. And Sunday morning, there's already sunrise, like 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, the closer you are to the North Pole, the South Pole, etc. So this is a phenomenon. It's supposed to be a very romantic time, and poets are inspired by it. They've written about the White Knights. I can't testify. I was in St. Petersburg 3 times. I was in Leningrad when I was there. But I cannot testify about the White Knights. But the White Knights present a tremendous halachic problem. Oh, what's the problem? Now you think for a minute. When do you say Kriyat Shema? You wake up, let's say Sopsman Kriyat Shema is 5:30 in the morning. Alright? Simon Kleinberg wakes up, he says Birchat HaTorah, he says Kriyat Shema. Did he do a proper thing? Maybe not, because Kriyat Shema Latchila, particularly in the morning, is a din Kriyat Shema Bichatecha, and you have to be Someich Gula Latfila. Now, what balabas daven's 5:30 in the morning? Most of you don't daven 5:30. I daven 5:30. All right, I daven 5:30. I daven actually 6 o'clock. I daven 5:30 on occasion, but most people don't daven that early. So in St. Petersburg, you had a terrible problem. Sobsman Kriyishma is 5 a.m. in the morning, and the minyan is first at 7 o'clock. And this is the dilemma. Do you say Kriyishma Birchatecha and lose the Tikkun Chazal, where it's Kriyishma Birchatecha? Do you say Kriyishma, excuse me, and Birchata Torah, and you lose the Tikkun Chazal of Kriyishma Birchatecha, and Bisamach Gula Latvila? Or no? You have to daven b'yechidot, and davening b'yechidot and being makayim kriyat shma u'birchatecha and smichat gula l'tfila is more important than tfila b'tzibah. That's the shaila. So the Rav related, and then the Tamusa and the memoir books, all the rabbanim started talking about this. Everyone got up and said an opinion, quoted a source, and then the host spoke last of Yitzchak Plaza. And he said 10 sentences of Musa. Didn't even relate to the topic. He sent 10 sentences of Musa. All right, they then met with the Tsar as representatives. The Beit HaLevi, a wagon, comes for him to take him back from St. Petersburg to Brisk. And it's a fairly long trip at that time. Fine. All the way, the Rev tells the story, all the way, as Zayin Elta Zaydu was sitting in the wagon, thinking to himself, what an amaretz. They say this is Rabbi Yitzchak Pederburger. This is the great Rebbe of St. Petersburg. This is the outstanding London of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. This is the man that says to know so much. What an amara, it's all about him, Galetin learning. Everyone spoke Naftalian learning. Everyone was Mephalpil on the Shaila. And he gets up and gives us 5 sentences of Musa, like a little high school kid from a Beis Yaakov that I spoke about in Los Angeles. Ugh. By the time the Briska Rav got home, he was boiling over. Walks into the house, kisses the mezuzah, kisses his wife. There was no TV at the kiss, right or wrong. And he asks his shamish, he says, bring me Arunti. He shows him on one of the top shelves. He has the pre-Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza already had published Chelek Aleph pre-Yitzchak. He says, bring me the pre-Yitzchak. Ich will sehen, was von Amoritz. The Pettenberger Rebbe's. Shamus goes up in the ladder, brings down from the Rebbe the Pre-Yitzchak. He opens up the Pre-Yitzchak and he literally faints. The first question is this very question. I'll show it to you in a second. And he deals with page after page after page after page with the greatest of sources, with Lambda Nut, with Amkut. And he finally reaches his conclusion. And Rebbe the Beit HaLevi was shaking. He says, "Yetz fashteich, now I first understand what Musa is all about." Could you imagine? He knew the topic better than anyone there, better than the Beit HaLevi, better than the other Gedolei Yisrael, knew the topic better than anyone. Bit his lips and said a few words of Musa like a Beis Yaakov high school girl, not to show off his lumdus, not to show off his learning. Okay, I'm holding in front of me the Pre-Yitzchak, and I want to mention, it came out Madura Shniyah with Chelik Aleph and Chelik Beit, which he later published, and it was given to me a gift when it came out by a Talmud with a beautiful, beautiful inscription. And I'll just take 2 minutes to tell you the story. You're Machanchem, you're going to get Smicha. You should know that every Talmud, what can be with a Talmud, this is a kid. I had a kid in my class, Mernick. This is the early years of BMT, a kid from Canada, one of the twins. His brother wrote a very famous song, Shifty, Shifty, Bevet Hashem, one of the Mernick twins. So I was very makpid when I taught on a collegiate level. I was very makpid on attendance. On a postgraduate level, I can't be makpid because you guys are older than me, bigger than me. You'll beat the hell out of me if I start taking attendance here. So I was very makpid. And Myrna comes over to me and says, Rebbe, I have to miss class tomorrow. My friend is coming in from Toronto. And I see the Yerut Shemayim him. There's much more to the story, but as you see, a full page inscription from a Talmud Neman L'Rabbo. Now, it's Simon Aleph. And he says, we live in the capital city, Yer HaMalucha, Petersburg. We don't say, in Hebrew, we don't say St. Petersburg. We just call it Petersburg. Now that the communism fell, they call it, if I'm not mistaken, Petrograd. They don't call it St. Petersburg, they call it Petersburg. If I'm not mistaken, when Yitz and I were there, it was called Leningrad. Under the Russians, this became Leningrad, this became Stalingrad. But now it reverted back to, but I don't think they call it St. Petersburg. I think they call it Petersburg. They have the Hermit. Forget about the Museum of Religion, the Hermitage. The Museum of Religion today probably has cobwebs on it because Russia's become a religious country again. But there they have the Hermitage. They have more art in the world with the big Shiloh. Naftali, are you allowed to wolf that art down? Yes or no? What do you say? You know what the Shiloh is? It's all robbed. It's all nationalized. It was all taken from people against their will. So it's a big Shiloh, but the art there defies imagination what they have. Okay, anyway, he says, we live in the capital city, the city of the king, Petersburg, where at times the nights are very short during the summer due to our aklim, you know, where we're located on the map. And therefore, Zman Kriyat Shema is very early. And at times the tzibur doesn't daven until long after Zman Kriyat Shema. Gentlemen, which is better? And this is an unbelievable shayla. It's a problem we have. The minute they're going to change the clock back, I think it's less than 2 weeks already. Now we go on to summer. It's hard to believe that the year is over. Tzvi, you're going to have that problem every Shabbos morning in Chutz Laaretz. We have that problem time and time again. Not always can you find an early minyan. Not always can you find a hashkama minyan. And some of you are so keyed already that Shabbos morning you sleep late. It's actually brought down in the Mordechai in Shabbos, that Shabbos morning you have to sleep later. So Baruch Hashem, all week I daven 6 o'clock, Shabbos morning I daven 6:30. But many of you, what does it mean sleep later? 8:30, a quarter to 9, I remember, there I am in Young Israel of Woodmere. I trust it became from a Young Israel of Woodmere, the place. I take a look, you know, in the middle of Chazaras Hashatz of Shachris, hundreds of people are walking into Davin, 9:30, they're walking into Davin. No, what do you do? Shalom, you may be a Chatan, but you have acted incorrectly. Because all of us, what do we do when we're in such places? What do we do? What do I do? I'm stuck in America, I'm someplace, I don't have an early minyan. Or I'm scholar in residence and I have to preach the sermon in the big minyan and they expect me to daven there. They brought me there for Shabbos and they want to show off a Rebbe from Gris Kollel in Yerushalayim that has such wonderful students, including those that just got engaged, like Shalom. Do we give Mazel Tov to? Okay, what do you do? What do? We wake up in the morning and we wash Negel Vasa and we say Birchat HaShach and we say Birchat HaTeira and we say Kriyat Shema. And then 3 hours later, we daven and repeat the Kriyat Shema with Birchotel, which we didn't say earlier, of course, HaMeir and Avarabba, etc., etc. And we're so Mechol LaTfila. Gentlemen, isn't this what we do? Yes or no? Is there anyone here that doesn't act this way? We are incorrect according to the Pri Yitzchak and according to the major lamdas. It is much better to daven be yichidit and be yotzei shma b'tikuna with the brachat. He brings down a gon, he brings down a shaket ayay, he brings down all the litvish asfarim, and he paskins la halacha that the main mitzvah in the morning is smichat gula l'tfila, and this can only be done when you yotzei kriyat shma, when it's a time of chiyav of kriyat shma, and therefore the only way to be mekayim this mitzvah, and it appears this is the gon shita, this is the way the shagat ayah learns, that what you have to do, you have to daven before when it is old zman kriyat shma b'klikrat kriyat shma b'zmana b'birchateha u'lesmoch gulale tefila b'zman kriyat shma u'memela. You had no choice. Yitpaleo gamkein biyechidut kein nira li. Wow. That's what he paskins lahalacha. And it reaches this conclusion, it takes him 14 pages, two columns, rabbinic folios, filled with lundas, filled with sources. There is nothing. There's nothing he doesn't know in this topic. And then he goes in Simon Bet, he goes into another interesting question, where the Tzibur davens before the Netzachama. In other words, you all know that Kriyishma, you can say already, Ben Sheyakir, Ben Lovin Letchelet, Ben Telet Lekate, you know, Kriyishma, you can say at a very early time, right with Alot HaShacha. But davening your Yotzei Lachatchila, the best way to daven is after the Netzachama. Isn't this what we call the daven vatikin? Like the daven at the cult, everyone's watching their watch. The chassan has a watch in front of him, and suddenly you see the sun come up, and at that moment everyone, it goes silent until then, was screaming and yelling and the breastlover and the davening, and suddenly it's totally silent. It's Shmon Esrei. So what about when the Tzibur davens after Alot HaShacha, but before the Netz? You know where that happens in Russia? During the winter. During the winter, when the sun rises late, you can't wait. You have to go to work. These are shalas, halach l'maisa. Reb Moshe deals with it too. And Reb Moshe, you know, in America too, many times you have to go to work, and you're davening, particularly in the heart of winter. Even in New York City, you're davening before the Netzach Hama. So there, he paskins, it's better to daven b'tzibur and to be yotzei kriyishman b'chatan b'someich gula l'tfila and to be yotzei tzvi b'dievid. You hear what I'm saying? B'dievid, to be yotzei shmon esrei, because yotzei you are b'dievid, even though it's not yet alot hashacha. So you see what a tremendous lamdan. Pri Yitzchak volume 2, Pri Yitzchak volume 1. He also was instrumental in putting out Reb Yisrael Salanter's Or Yisrael, the 22 letters. The man was a lamdan mufak. But he suffered in the rabbinate. And it wasn't just the fight with the Jews. It is rumored. We can never establish this. Many years later, after 16 years in the rabbinate, this was 16 years in a key position. This is not like you're going to go into the rabbinate, so they start you off in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Right? And every rabbi struggles to come back to New York. I know Rabbanim who gave up wonderful shtelas out of town where they didn't have any yankos. They had 90% Sipuka Nefesh, 10% Akmat Nefesh. But they had to come back to the New York area, they wound up 90% Akmas Nefesh, 10% Sipuk Nefesh. And I gave, you all know examples, and I know examples. I helped one of them. Actually, one of them, I found him a very important new job where I knew he would be appreciated, and so far I was absolutely right. But everyone wants to get back to the New York area. So to give up, Ariel has to ask a question. For Rav Yitzchak Plaza to willingly leave the rabbinate of St. Petersburg at the end of 16 years, why? Kepasa, what happened? I mean, the Maskilim were all off. All right, Yalag, the heart, St. Petersburg. Yeah, I'll tell you what happened. The Russian Orthodox Church. There was a terrible problem that we live with and still suffer with. People in modern times, Judaism for most Jews is unimportant. You know, we don't realize it. We're so caught up with the swing to the right. We're so caught up with the machloikit, with the right, with the left. Everyone, there's a big debate going on whether Tinek, whether my student, Rabbi Przanski, did the right thing to have over three. You don't realize. I gave it out 2 weeks ago. You thought I was giving out a joke. You don't realize what's happening. That he had over three big Rab Reshi Yeshiva from the right-wing world. And people are furious at him. Why should we have Rabbi Solomon over if they won't let Rabbi Lichtenstein speak in Lakewood? Why should we have Rabbi Feldman over, let Rabbi Heschel Shechter give his shiur in Baltimore? This is a serious debate. So, you know, we're caught up with the world. Baruch Hashem, Frumkeit, wonderful, good. Around us, the rate of assimilation is 60-70% into marriage, kids, college, university, reform, conservative. There's no longer conservative, it's all reform. Who gives a hoot about Yiddishkeit? So what was happening in Russia, lo aleinu, it's hard to believe, to get ahead, many Jews became Russian Orthodox. You became Russian Orthodox like Fulbright, like the Secretary of State of the United States. What was it? She was Jewish. So say that very simple. Women are closer to God than men. This is a statistic. It's a proven fact. Rakefet will go into it and explain it to you why. There are biological and scientific reasons why. The research has proven what Rabbi Soloveitchik said in the 60s, 100% correct. But that's not important. Fact. In Russia, under the communists, who kept the churches open? The babushkas. The old ladies, they were the ones that went on Sunday despite Stalin, despite communism. They kept the churches open. Lahavdil. So look what happened time and again. The husband who wanted to get ahead became Russian Orthodox. He was a businessman. He needed the contacts. His wife refused to leave Judaism. So she needs a get. This is the tragedy. He can become Russian Orthodox, but she needs a get. Okay. In order to show the priest how sincere she was, he would give her a get. Can anyone tell me where the get would be given? In the church, under the idols. And believe me, the Russian Orthodox, boy, do they have idols. Under the idols, under the getchkas, that's where the priest would set up a table and chairs for the basin. That's where the basin would have to come in to be Masadar again. Mutali, you're going into the Rapnid. Are you allowed to go into a church to surrender the crucifix to be Masadar again? Yes or no? Avadis, Pikuach Nefesh, you're saving a woman. Otherwise, she's an Aguna. We do everything possible to save an Aguna. You're not worshipping the idols. But believe me, it's no joy for a Yiddish Neshama to sit under a guy bleeding with some crucifix there, was licked halb and dread and destroyed the whole world. And we have to sit under that getchka. So Reb Itzla Peterburger, they say, made up his mind to leave the rabbinate because he could not take having to go into the church to give these type of gittin. It happened too often, and he was just sick and disgusted. And in 1878, he made up his mind, genug, I've been in the rabbinate 16 years. His Rebbe was an old man at the time, living in Germany. No one could force him to keep on going. And he left the Rabbinate and came back to Kovna. Why to Kovna? The center, the hotbed. Again, Kovna, 1878. Why to Kovna? 16 years he was in the Rabbinate. 16 years he was chief rabbi of St. Petersburg. Kovna was the hotbed. It's like going to New York. People out of town, they want to come to New York. I know that from all over America, I've seen this with my own eyes, I'm walking along the streets of Borough Park on a hot Shabbos in the middle of the summer, and suddenly I see a flock of girls walking, and I say, where are you from? Mexico, Beis Yaakov, Mexico City. They brought them to Borough Park to experience a Jewish Shabbos. And it's true, I have to tell you, in Borough Park, much less traffic. The buses run absolutely empty. You look at the buses, you see two or three people sitting in them during the week. They're standing room only. For these people, they take a see a Shabbos. It's beyond comparison to what they have back in Mexico City. You see a whole group from Tucson, Arizona. You see a whole group from here, from there. They bring them to Borough Park. They bring the Chabadnik and bring them to Eastern Parkway, etc. So he went back to Kovna. Now, there's one part of his life that's fascinating. He and his wife had no children. So when you don't have children, you don't have big expenses. Those of you that have become parents for the first time this year, those of you who are parents, as the Rebbe, yours truly, has told you, the day that I gave you Mazel Tov, your life changes forever. Michael Shore, until then he could shore up the sea whenever he wanted. Once you're a father, once you're a mother, life changes forever. It's a responsibility. It's not a responsibility. It's the money that you spend on children to clothe them, to feed them, to educate. I'm not going into the halacha now, whether you're chayiv or not chayiv. It could be only chayiv till the kid is 6 or 7, right or wrong. It could be everything we do beyond that is mamish gemilat chesed. But that's not the point. Do you have a right to say, shepatrani miyon shoshalzeh? Are you really out of it when the kid turns 13 today? Some people say it without a shein v'malchut. Some say it with a shein v'malchut. Interesting questions. But one thing is for sure. Children drain your finances. Baruch Hashem, the kid should go on a good path, and you're the happiest person alive to see that they drain your finances. No, Rabbi Yitzchak had no lack of money. He made a good living. He was chief rabbi. He and his wife, what do Musaniks live on? Pheasant on the glass, they didn't eat. They saved up money. Ah, what did they do with the money? When they moved to Kovna, they bought a boarding house. So that they ran, his wife ran a big boarding house, and they had a dining room. And his job was to sit and learn, and then Musa, but when she needed help, he was called out, and he wasn't a Baal Gaiva. I told you he was a Musanik. He was more than happy to help. And here you have one of the cutest stories ever. And again, it's anecdotal, but it appears already in all the Sfarim, and it probably happened. One time, everyone, you know, people are coming to Kovna, a place to eat, so you can be certain that in Rav Yitzchak Plaz's boarding house, you could eat with peace of mind. So the place was crowded, and his wife presses the emergency bell and calls him out of the Beis Medrash at Daf Helfman. He has to help serve supper. They have a big crowd that night. So here is the great Rav Yitzchak Plaza coming with a tray, carrying hot soup and serving the people. And evidently among them were Lamdanim, and they turned to him with a twinkle in their eyes. Itzela, Itzela, Zagdi Yemes, tell the truth. He says, Besser, this is better that you're a waiter serving hot soup than, and you could still have been the chief rabbi, Rabbi Itzla Petterburger, and this is better? And Rabbi Itzla doesn't waste a moment's time. He says, absolutely, says, when I was chief rabbi of St. Petersburg, I had so much aggravation, so many problems with the Tsar, with the Russian Catholic hierarchy. I never had a moment where I could think with menuchat hanefesh in learning a Rashi, a Tosfos, a Rambam, a Ravid. I was fatumult. He says, here it's a pleasure. I can walk with a tray to serve food, and I can think of Rashi and Tosfos and Rambam and Ravid without Akmas Nefesh, and no one is bothering me. He says, can ich trachten and lernen? This is much better. Postscript dated by Anra Kefet. I would make it my point when I ate in the Kovna boarding house owned by the Blazers, whenever he would serve the hot soup, I always walked away from the table. Say, I left my seat empty. Let him serve it. Then I'll sit down to eat it. I didn't want to run any chance that suddenly he got the Terence the Tysmus, and he got so excited, he shook the tray and the hot soup. You know, when he served the meat and potatoes and fish, some zangazint, I sat there. But with the hot soup, I got up for one moment to breathe a little higher. But this was a Metzler Petter, where again, these are the Musa stories. See, there's a Hasidic story. This is a Musa story. No Hasidic Rebbe. Could you picture Rebbe working and we're owning a motel and serving hot soup? All right, Shiraim is one thing. But this is a Musa story. And the way he said, ich hab getracht und lernen. Now, because he didn't need money, because he was independently wealthy, so that's how Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza got involved in the Kovna Kollel. When Rabbi Yisrael Salanter established it in the late 1870s. And again, Rabbi Yisrael wanted Rabbi Tzolkonin to head it up. Now, Rabbi Tzolkonin, I told you, there's a limit what one person can do. I know that feeling. I mean, I reached the limit. You can, all these requests I get to give public lectures in Israel, I turn them down basically, unless it's... And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming. Those of you that went through a Baron Shear last night, did it work out? There was no problem? The time worked out? I see a big response here. But wake up. Yeah, it worked out. Simon, it worked out? Yeah, what time did the Ram begin Shear? Okay. Because we were supposed to start after 7. That was the arrangement, and the boys was supposedly to be told that they could bring supper to class. Okay. Anyway, so Rabitzla had time on his hands. In other words, he didn't need panasa, he didn't need a living. So when they organized the kollel, Tzolkonin couldn't run it on a daily basis. So he put his son in Reb Tzvi Hirsch. Reb Tzvi Hirsch was yet half a businessman at the time. So Reb Yitzchak Plaza was a natural to come into the kollel and to run it. And he ran it on a daily basis. He never accepted a penny, never accepted a kopeck. And here too is the famous story about the cigarettes. You know the story with the cigarettes? First of all, everyone smoked at that time. No one knew that smoking was not healthy. Everyone considered it a luxury. It's a sign of civilization. Everyone smoked. So when they would have a board meeting about the people running the kollel, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz, Reb Yitzchak Blasser, a few other people, whenever they would meet, so today when you have a meeting, what do you put on the table? You put tea, coffee, some cake. This is what you put on the table when you have a meeting. They would put cigarettes on the table. He would not take a cigarette because he said he is a volunteer in the kollel. He doesn't take a salary. He doesn't want to take cigarettes. He does everything l'shem shemayim. Now, because he could devote so much time to the kollel, it became a double-edged sword. Those that opposed Musa started complaining that Reb Yitzchak Blasser has too much influence in the kollel. And as a result of the so-called having too much influence, ultimately Reb Yitzchak Blasser had to leave the administration of the kollel, because otherwise the intensity of the opposition to Musa became so strong that his presence became a lightning rod. Why you? Too, there was a big rough. Reb Moshe Danishevsky, because it had such rabbinic figures, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz afterwards, and afterwards the Devar Avraham, Kovno was a magnet for young people to come and study. It's not that there was a yeshiva in Kovno, but the Batei Midrashim were filled, people were sitting and learning, you had the Kovno Kollel, you had Elderet Talmidim you could go to, you could talk, you could ask advice, you could speak and learning. When I learned in Lakewood, there was only one Rosh Yeshiva, there was only one Shir, a Baron Kotler. 90% of the students were not on a level to totally comprehend a Baron Kotler. But you would speak and learning with the older students. Yankel Schiff, who later marries the Briska Rav's daughter and lives in Yerushalayim today, his nephew studied in BMT, it was very fascinating. His nephew studied, it was his sister's son, studied in BMT, would go there for Shabbos, I would send regards, I was curious if he remembered me. But Rabbi Yankel Schiff, you had to make an appointment to talk with him in learning. He had blocked out time every afternoon, blocked out a few hours where he spoke in learning with whomever wanted to talk with him. You had to make an appointment a week in advance. And you would talk with him, and he could be Masbir, the Rosh Yeshiva. He was like Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. I knew two people on that level in my youth. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who I knew from 51 on, and Rabbi Yankel Schiff, who I knew from 53 on. And people would come into the Batei Medrash. It was a magnet because you had these Torah personalities. There was a lot to find in Kovno. One of the people who wandered into Kovno was the son of a Rav in a neighboring community, the Plener Rav's son. His name was Dov Revel. You know him by his Americanized name, Bernard Revel. So that Bernard Revel, or Dov Revel, in his youth, came into Kovno, studied in Kovno, knew Reb Yitzchak Blasser. And as I said, as I wrote, and even though Reb Nosson Kamenetsky challenges me, and I believe the truth is someplace in the middle, but there's no question that through the Musa climate in Kovno, he was exposed to the Chovat HaLevavot, and later at NYU, he writes a master thesis on the Chovat HaLevavot. And when he organizes what today is Yeshiva University, then it's Yeshiva Tzipitzchol Chanan, and reorganizes it in Yeshiva, Yeshiva College, there certainly is an atmosphere that is not opposed to Musa. Whether you can call it a Musa Yeshiva in the classical sense, we'll leave that question hang fire. But there certainly was an atmosphere which was not opposed to Musa, and I attribute it to the time that Dov Revel, who was known as the Prene Eloy, his father died when he was 12 years old, and they put Dov Revel, stood up on a crate, and he eulogized his father. He was already a good Lamdan as a youngster, a photographic memory. I know this from eyewitnesses. He knew all of Shas and Tosfot by heart. And he was in Kovno, and he imbued of that Musa spirit. So that's one connection. But now we come to the most famous connection of all. The Rav immortalized Reb Yitzchak Blasser.
Can anyone tell me where? Young rabbi's about to get smicha. The Rav we're talking about. This is not esoteria, but exoteria. Perhaps one of the most famous passages in the Rav's magnum opus, the Ish Halakha, is about Reb Yitzchak Blasa. And now let me tell you, with the Ish Halakha, I'm quoting, you should know that this was published by the Rebbe in 1944. It's the first item of unbelievable importance that he ever published, and the last. He didn't publish it again for many, many decades. Rakefet's theory. Why did the Rav suddenly break with his perfectionism, with the brisket tradition, not to publish? Reb Chaim published nothing. Reb Meisher published nothing. Suddenly he published Ish Halakha. You know what my theory is? Very simple. 44, he was just establishing himself as the Rosh Yeshiva in YU. He was involved in a bit of fight. This was written, this was composed. Originally it was an oral presentation to the Hebrew club in Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. Then he wrote it up. And these were years he was struggling. He wanted to be recognized. Remember, you're not born the Rav. That's what some young people don't understand. This is not Hasidus. The Belzer Rebbe's kid, that kid today who goes all over the world, that fat little kid, people were drinking L'chaim to him at the age of 12, 13. I would have smacked the kid's face and threw him out for drinking liquor, holding liquor with his hand. What are you talking? But I'm a Litvak. You got to be a chassid to appreciate that. Okay? And I'm not putting it down. That's chassidus, but it's not the Litvish Shevelt. So the Rav was struggling. So he wanted to publish something the world should know a little bit what he's capable of. Ish Halakha's magnum opus in philosophy. As long as human beings walk the face of the earth, they will be studying the Ish Halakha, Jew or non-Jew. It's an unbelievable piece. Now, for many decades, it wasn't available. Then, Pinchas Peli, and he did this without the Rav's permission, put out a sefer, Besod HaYachid VaHayachid. I mean, the title, Pinchas Peli, was a genius in Hebrew. This was these three brothers born to a home from the old city, from the and each one became a genius in his world. One became conservative, one became reform, and one remained modern orthodox. Unbelievable. The one who's modern orthodox is still alive, should live me well, Rav Mordechai HaKohen. But the others changed their names. Pinchas Peli became Pinchas Peli, and the other one became Shmuel Avidur. He just died recently, although in his old age he came back, Baruch Hashem, to Yiddishkeit, gave up the Yiddishkeit with reform. Anyway, he republished, Besod HaYachid VaYachid means the secret of aloneness and togetherness. And it's a perfect title for a good deal of the thrust of the Rav's philosophic shtanz. So I'm quoting, he republished Ish Halakha without the Rav's permission. It caused a lot of heartache, and I don't want to go into detail, but the Rav got an injunction against him and threatened to put him into Chayrim, etc., etc. Anyway, beginning on page 121, and you'll have to find it, there's so many editions of Ish Halakha today, but this is the one that I have handiest in my library, so I'm quoting from that one. The Rav is going in, why did his family oppose Messiah? Rav goes in, famous, he speaks, That the greatest Ishe Halakha, my family, Reb Chaim Ishbrisk, Reb Nitziv Ishfalashin, Ukiyotze Be'elo, wouldn't allow Musa into Velashin, the type of Musa that Reb Yisrael Ish Salant preached. And then he tells the following story. And this became world famous. It's quoted and requoted and quoted and requoted. He tells the following story. Remember, we said Reb Yitzchak Blasa was a Musanik. Rabbi Yitzchak Blasa had time on his hands when he came to Kufna. Rabbi Yitzchak Blasa made a very simple decision in the 1880s. By the way, Reb Nesson Kamenetsky spends endless pages trying to establish exactly what year this happened. It's an amazing thing. In the making of a gadol, this story mesmerizes Reb Nesson, and he spends endless, igmamish, you have no idea, I call it a historic pilpul, trying to establish exactly what year this happened. It has to be sometime in the 1880s. Reb Yitzchak Blasa was very smart. You want to change the world, you have to change the rabbis. How do you change the rabbis? Go to the school that turns out the rabbis. Decided to go to Velashen and to influence the Gedolei Yisrael in Velashen, introduce Musa. Three, follow the example of Reb Yisrael Salanta. Michael, shore up Velashen with the Musa technique. Okay, I'm quoting the Rav. Reb Yitzchak Ish Petersburg comes to Voloshin and he meets with Reb Chaim. Could you imagine this meeting? Halavai, we were there, but the Rav has the tradition of what happened. Here's Reb Yitzchak Plaza meeting with Reb Chaim Briska. And he says to Reb Chaim, you must introduce Musa because Chazal require it. And at Seich and Dan, he quotes the Gemara in Bracha Taf Hei Omer Aleph. Omer Reb Levi Bachama. By the way, when the Rav wrote Ishna Lachad, it's an amazing thing. He never gave, he would say, Chazal say, didn't give sources. See, this is where Chaim will find fault with his father. Because when you cite something, you have to give an exact source. Now, this is an easy source. What do you do when the Rav says in Zohar state, no, go and find that Zohar. I know a guy named Aaron Rakefet. The days, not hours, the days he put in to find the source that the Rav referred to in the Zohar. And he came up with something, and that's why he writes a tribute. He has a footnote. Rakefet is scholarly, very honest. He writes a footnote that is what he thinks the Rav meant, because we can't be certain, because the Rav can fashtain the time going to shook up. The way he understood it, that's what I think he meant. But here, it's an easy Gemara. Brachat Heyom and Aleph. Omer Reb Levi Bachama Reb Shimon Lakash. Leolim Yagiz Adam Yetzar Toiv Al Yetzar Ra. Shemema Rigzuvi Al Techeto. Im Nitzku Mutav V'im Lav Yasok B'Torah. Im Nitzku Mutav V'im Lav Yaskilo Yom Hamita. And what a Gemara. Look what the Gemara is saying. The Yetzer Hara wants to get the best of you. You gotta fight that Yetzer Hara. You gotta push the Yetzer HaTov. And there's only one way to do it, to learn Torah. And sometimes you learn Torah. It's not enough. People learn Torah, they go out, they rob, they steal, they kill, they rape, they seduce. I don't have to tell you what's in the news recently. God have mercy. These are people who learn Torah, taught Torah. If that's not enough, you gotta frighten the person. Remind him of Yom HaMita. Going to the Misakloys. Where you come from? Where you going? What's going to be with you? And Reb Yitzchak Plaza went on and on elaborating. We see that Misr is required. Take him into the Lashon. Take him into the Beit Medrash. Take him into the Yeshiva. Sit down and learn. There's only one way to conquer that Yetzer Hara. And it has nothing to do with Misa, nothing to do with Yom Hamita, Mashul of Beit HaMedrash. The Gemara in Brachot says the opposite. Did Reb Chaim let Reb Yitzchak Plaza have it? He says, what is the Gemara in Brachot talking about? When a person is sick. Sometimes a person is sick, he has to take bitter medicine. He has to take Shemen Kick. You guys don't even know what Shemen Kick was. Castor oil. When I was a kid, you came down to the office, 1944, you told the secretary you didn't feel well, they took out a bottle of castor oil. Suddenly you felt better. The last thing in the world you wanted to taste was a spoonful of castor oil. So Reb Chaim says, a sick person takes castor oil, he feels better. A healthy person takes castor oil, he gets sick. You people in Kovna, you're sick. You have psychological, emotional problems. You have anomalies of faith and questions. You need castor oil. You need Musa. You need the Yom HaMita. We in Voloshin, he's not in Brisk, only in Voloshin, Hineinu Baruch Hashem, Bliim, B'nefesh U'Vaguf, Shleimim B'Torateinu, V'Yein Sodech Kan, B'Shemen Kik. We are healthy, we are well, we don't need castor oil. Im Chachmei Kovna V'Kelem, and Kelem already had become a Musa sentence, we'll see next time. If the sages of Kovna and Kelem have to drink from the bitter waters, it's a play on Mayim Hamarim of the Salta, let them drink K'chol Avat Nafshom as much as they want. Let them drink, let them get drunk. Aval Al Yasminu Acherim L'Smodi Machem. They shouldn't invite others to partake of that sickening castor oil. And that's the Rav, that's the Ish Halacha. That is one of the most famous, if not the most famous, passage in Nishalacha, the dialogue between Reb Chaim, the dialogue between Reb Chaim and Reb Yitzchak Plaza. And Reb Yitzchak Plaza had to go back to Kovna, Avel v'chafui rosh, to paraphrase the Megillah. He did not succeed. The Lashon did not. It refused to introduce Musa. Okay, everybody with me? Now you can... Stayed missing. Yeah, well, I'll only answer you as follows. As far as the Vilna Gaon goes, they can say very simply that had he not opposed them, they wouldn't have remained from. That's what the Aruch, as I showed you, that's what the Makar Baruch says in the name of the Tzemach Tzedek, and it makes sense. As far as Musa, we'll come to the opposition. Musa, remember, so far, I've never said anything negative about Musa. I will say it in due context, and then you'll be able to judge why there was opposition. But right now, it's too early to deal with your comment. But you're right, in theory, what Yitzchak is saying, I have to say, imagine had Bialik learned Musa. Remember, I quoted to you David Miller last week, the joy of the secret of the Jew, the secret of happiness. Those books. Remember the little green books and then the blue pamphlet on how to build the mikvah. And he says, I only remain firm in Oakland. I only remain firm in America because of Musa. So there's something to be said for that, but you can't rewrite history. At that moment, they were opposed. We'll talk about that because the Rebbe explains when he... it's not yet. I don't want to confuse the class. But what I want to do... now I've arrived. Gentlemen, I've shown you one connection to YU through Dov Revel. I've showed you another connection, the Rav in Ish Halacha. Can anyone give me the most important, tangible connection, David Hachthauser, Naftali Wolf, there I am, a young kid, and standing in front of me is a Chadni Gadol Yisrael in YU, telling stories about his stepfather, Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza. What am I talking about? How many of you have been tingling? How many of you know the family? Gentlemen, what did we say? Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza was married and had no children. When she turned 50, she came to her husband, it's a true story, and said, darling, I want you to give me a get. I want you to marry a younger woman with whom you can have children. She evidently knew that it was her problem, not his problem. And this is what you call in rabbinic aphorism, get me ahava. Sometimes we divorce our wives out of love. I know there's another case like this in modern times, where a guy, he was a son of an Altamira who made it very big in Antwerp, and a Shanghai survivor. And he was married to this woman many years, had no children, and they got divorced out of love. He gave her a tremendous settlement, bought her a home in Israel, and he married a young woman and had children. So he gave her a get. And he gave her a bracha. This woman, his widow, was Ma'aricha Yamim in Tel Aviv. She yet lived to see the state of Israel declared. I don't know, she was 100 when she died. And they asked her, why were you privileged to live such a long life? She said, because when my husband gave me the get, he gave me enough money I could live the rest of my life and gave me a bracha that I should have a richa jamim and never have aggravation. And then he remarried a young widow who had 4 small children. Now you got to remember that in those days, men, people died young. Women died in childbirth. I told you, I told the caller many times, I grew up with kids in Yeshiva Salanta whose mothers were really their aunts. I only learned that later, that their mothers died in childbirth in Europe, and immediately a younger sister, after the Shloshim, she would marry the father so there'd be someone to take care of the house, take care of the children. This is an era, first of all, where you need someone to take care of the children. Today, we don't give a hoot about our children. Today, every child in America speaks Spanish. Everyone works. The women work. The women have professions. Half of Lawrence, half of the 5 towns where they're little children, by day, they have Spanish-speaking maids that take care of them. You can't even find in Russian. You can't find an Israeli anymore. The Spanish speakers have a monopoly. But in those days, you needed women to raise children. That was one. Two, men didn't know how to go into a kitchen. Men simply needed women to cook food, otherwise they'd starve to death. I mean, I'm just stating a fact. I'm self-sufficient. I'm proud of it. My father, Zichrono Levracha, would have starved to death if not for my mother. My mother's second husband, I don't think he knew how to boil up a cup of water for coffee, just like my father didn't know how. I mean, this is a problem. So these women raised their nephews with nieces with love because it was an aunt. You didn't know it wasn't the mother. It was a mother's sister. There's nothing closer than that. So people died young. So here's a widow with four children in her late 20s. Who's going to marry her? Rabbi Yitzchak Blasa married her, and he had four more children with her. So within a few years, a man that had no aggravation and no children and no responsibility, he had eight children. Now, the stories are legendary of how he raised his children. In the morning, he had to wake them up. You know, the biggest problem is Kriyat Shema. I always thank God I only had daughters because I would have come down too hard on sons. I wouldn't, you know, I didn't have seichel then. I was much younger. I was your age. And I would, get up, you know, grandchildren, I have rachmanis. I can't, it's hard for me to wake up a grandchild. But daughters, you don't have to wake up for Kriyat Shema. Today you do. Today already the women want to do everything the men want to do. The men don't want to do. The men don't want to do. The women want to do. Today's a different world. So he would wake up the children. Very interesting. Psychologically, you can debate this. He would wake up the children, his own children. Steh auf! Man Kriyat Shema, get up! The kids that weren't his own, he would say, please, ich bet baich, I'm ask you, I request, please get up. Please, it's Man Kriyat Shema. So they asked him, how come you differentiated? So he said, because my own children never experienced being Yatomim. But my elder children that are my wife's children, they were orphans. They suffered. They didn't have a father. I never want to say a harsh word to them, even to wake them up for Kriyat Shema. So that, God forbid, I don't want them to remember the hard moments of their life. And if I'll wake them up with force, they may recall when they were orphans what they suffered. And this is legendary, how he used to wake up his own children with shtakkeit and his other children with ziskeit. Learn a little Yiddish. Mit shtakkeit und mit ziskeit. What a difference. Gentlemen, of all his eight children, can anyone tell me who became Echad Megedolei Gedolei Yisrael that I yet had the privilege to know, that Rabbi Lichtenstein considers him next to the Rav, his Rebbe Mufak? Rabbi Aaron had three Rebbeim, Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner, Rabbi Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, and the Ramsha Rav, Rav Moshe Shatzkis. Who raised Rav Moshe Shatzkis? He was a stepson of Rabbi Yitzchak Blasa. Rabbi Yitzchak Blasa adopted him when he married his mother. He was one of the four orphans. And he became Lamsha Rav. He became Rav. He was a youngster when he was raised. One of the Rav used, he spoke about, I'll tell you a vort from the Rav now. The Rav spoke about the Medrash, the Mut Yaakov Chakukal Kisei HaKovet. That the Demut of Yaakov Avinu, the Medrash Rabbah, is on the Kisei HaKovet. So the Rav asked, why the Mut Yaakov? Well, what? Why Yaakov? Why was he Zaycha? Why not Avram Avinu, Yitzchak Avinu? Why Davke Yaakov Avinu? The Mut Yaakov Chakukal Kisei HaKovet. And the Rav gave a beautiful answer. I don't know. It may not be his Tashanut. I mean, this could be. It came before him, but he said it over. The Rav said, because what was the difference between Yaakov Avinu and his forebears? Yaakov Avinu was the last of the Avot before he go into Galus. With Yaakov Avinu, the Galus Mitzrayim begins. And the Yebishter wanted to have an image of what a Jew looked like. The last of the Jews, the last of the Avot, the last of the previous generations. And that's why the Mut Yaakov, the Jews have gone into Galus, but the Yebishter consoles himself because he still has in front of him an image, the Ayid, the Arav, had Iska cooked. And Rebbe went in to eulogize the Lamsha Rav. He was the last of the great Rabbanim of Europe. This was the last. This was a Lamdan Muvok. The Rav described how he knew all of Yerodeya by heart, every Shachan Taz by heart. The Rav described how he walked with the princely look, with the Hadrat HaPoh. upon him, the way he related to the world, his beautiful sense of humor. Rav Moshe Shchatzkis was famous for his sense of humor, and he said Halavia that what does the Eibishter do? He plays with the Leviathan, Misachek. He spoke about his ability, how he could survive Hitler and survive the world and survive anti-Semitism and come to America and be Matzliach in America and integrate under YU scene, and his children, his grave taught in YU, and his grandchildren went to YU, and part of the family lives in London today. There's the Shatzkis family there, Shatzkis family in America, and he was Reb Yitzchak Blasser's son and raised by Reb Yitzchak Blasser's stepson. So I had the schut. I yet knew the Lamjurav. Ach, this is the most famous of all his children. So we in YU have a direct connection to Reb Itzler Peterburg, to Reb Yitzchak Blasser. You want an example of Rav Shatzkis' sense of humor? I'll tell you a little episode in honor of Shalom, but Ariel, don't wake him up. You'll tell him afterwards, because when a guy gets engaged, never he's on the phone. He has problems. He has to make decisions. It's all over. You get engaged, you get married, you have children. Baruch Hashem, the generations continue in dignity. Love your wives. It's the greatest gift that God gave you. If I ever hear that you guys fight with your wife, I'm going to get very angry. And God forbid, no divorces. I had enough divorces here in the Kollel of old timers. Ach, Simon, let me tell you a good story. I heard this from my witnesses. Reb Moshe Shatzkis lived in Williamsburg. Shabbos, you know, he would daven in whatever shul he davened there, and there was a Suda Shlishit there, and he was sitting there with other under a Rabbanim, and they came over and they said, oh, Chaim Yankel just got engaged to this girl. Well, they knew the families, and someone says, and again, you got to know Yiddish to appreciate this, aglata shirich. How would you say that in English? You know, it's a shirich, a pasika shirich, matim. Shidduch matim, a fitting shidduch. They know the boy, know the girl, know the families. And suddenly the Lam Sharev pops up. Wie kann das sein, a glattisch? How can it be? How are you saying that it's good, it matches? He says, it's impossible. He says, one is a man and one is a woman. To begin with, they're different. And you know, everyone's sitting there astounded. What could they answer? You know, the Lam Sharev was right. He's right. But on the other hand, there was a good witz. There was a good sense of humor. He said, to begin with, how are you not glattisch shidduch? Sie ist erfreut als ein Mensch, ein Mann. What are you? Okay, that was the Lam Sharev. What an era. There's another classic story with Lam Sharev that is absolutely true. He barely knew the names of the students while he had 30, 40 people sitting in front of him. He was an elder person already. He knew all of Shas by heart, all of Shulchan Aruch. He didn't know all the names. So one time he looks at the attendance list and he says, Feinberg! Zug the Gemara, you know, you start the Gemara, read the Gemara. And Feinberg yells back, Rebbe, Feinberg is nishtachain, he's not here today, he wasn't prepared. So Rav Shep says, Eba Zay, do Zalim the Gemara, you read the Gemara. And that's another classic story on the Lam Sharev. Now, let's come back to Rav Yitzchak Blasser. Come back, we have to finish off in a minute, but we won't finish his whole life, we have a little bit more to go. Right, it was the suburb. We're going to come to it, but not yet. This Slabatka Yeshiva first is organized in 1882, and it first becomes something after the Lushan closes. But we'll come, there was tremendous controversy. We'll get there. Now, Rabbi Yitzchak Blasser, what did the Musan extreme about? You see, again, when you're Kulo Torah, then there has to be Eretz Yisrael. You cannot remove Eretz Yisrael from the constellation of Torah. And particularly if you're a Musanik and you're honest. So Reb Yitzchak Blasser and others as well, as we'll see, dreamt about the moment they could go in Aliyah. Now Reb Yisrael Solanta was very smart, very a tremendous foresight. He had all this money available from the German donors. Obadja Lachman was only one of many. So what did he do with the money? A good deal of it went to Lithuania. A good deal of it went into the Kupna Kollel. A good deal of it went to publish Tavuna. A good deal of it went to publish Musa Classics. He also bought up property in the old city. It was what was called the Strauss Courtyard. And Reb Yisrael bought up one apartment after another and deeded it to a Musa Trust. So that meant that the Musaniks, the well-known Rabbanim, when they wanted to go in Aliyah, had where to go to. They would contact whoever was administrating the Strauss courtyard, and they would be told, we've reserved a little apartment for you, you can come in Aliyah. 1904, Rav Yitzchak Blazinow, his children are married, he feels free to leave behind the 8 children, and he and his wife are coming on Aliyah. Before he leaves Europe, he visits all his old friends, and Yom Kippur, where do you think he spends it? By then, the most famous Musa Yeshiva, what Rabbi Rubin just mentioned a second ago, he spends it in Slabodka. One of the young students in Slabodka was, at that time, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. And on Yom Kippur, the whole yeshiva is excited, is thrilled. Look who they have there. Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer is their guest. And they machabed him, this great Rabbi Yitzchak Petterburg, a man with so many achievements, the author of the Pri Yitzchak, Chelik Aleph, Chelik Bet, they machabed him to give the drasha. And that drasha left an unbelievable impact on Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. And I end off the class quoting from the Rakofet Aron, Chelik Aleph, page 131. And this is Reb Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg speaking. I remembered vividly the drasha he gave on the Yom Kippur before he went to Eretz Yisrael. It was in the Slabodka Yeshiva where he stood wearing a white kittel and wrapped in his talis. He was pale, thin, and tall. His text was, cast me not away in my old age, Al Tashpichein Eliyat Sikna, Psalm 71:9. He told the story of soldiers who left their posts and fled the country to avoid being tried as deserters. After some years, a new king issued a pardon on condition that they return to complete their military service. One old soldier agreed to come back. But when the country's officials saw his age-worn body, they scoffed at him and said he was of no value any longer. In telling this, Reb Yitzchak almost collapsed and then cried out to his students, how fortunate you are that you are young. If you apply your time and energy, you can still reach great heights. Have pity on a poor old man who wasted his time on earth. The effects of this talk cannot be described. We felt an electric shock pass through us. Here was a great man who had not stopped learning all his life, sobbing his fear that he had not fulfilled his duty to the Almighty. That was Reb Yitzchak Blazer. David, you now heard a live description from someone in his youth who had the privilege of seeing Reb Yitzchak Blazer. That's Reb Yechiel Yaakov. He was very moved. It affected his thinking, it affected his scholarship, and I don't have to tell you Reb Yechiel Yaakov's essays on Reb Yitzchak Blazer, on Rav Naftali Amsterdam, on Rav Simchel Zimso Broida, which appear in the fourth volume of the old edition of the Sri Deyesh, was second to none. And I end off, Reb Yitzchak Blazer gets to Yerushalayim, but he only has a few years here. 1907, he was an old man already. You can't defeat age. His health became impaired. They sent him to Jaffa. The doctors told him that he needs the air. You know, people used to say, I remember I used to go to Rakhistan, the air was on, buried on Har HaZaitim. If I'm not mistaken, they were able to find his monument and reconstruct his grave after the Six-Day War. There was a whole Musa area where Gedolei HaMusa are buried on Har HaZaitim. So my dear students, do you want to know Rabbi Yisrael Salanta? You have to know his students. And Rabbi Yisrael had 3 great students. We discussed one today, but Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer was the Lamdan Mufak. The story about
The Pri Yitzchak Tshuva Aleph is legendary. How the Beit HaLevi rode all the way back thinking, what type of person is this? How little does he know? Five lines of Beis Yaakov type Musa that a girl in high school could give you, not just from New York Beis Yaakov, but the Yaakov, but from L.A. Beis Yaakov. And Rabbi Yitzchak Blaza, look at the Pri Yitzchak, Lamdis, knew the topic better than anyone. And yet, Musa didn't allow him to show off, to be boastful. This is Rabbi Yitzchak. The story of his life, St. Petersburg, the Gittin, the Machlokes with Yalag, why he left, Kovna, the house, the waiter, the Kovna Kolel, unbelievably fascinating. For us, in the shadow of the first Chanukah Smicha ever, in the 100-year-plus history of Yeshiva University, we see so many connections with Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza, Dov Revel, the Rav Ish Halacha, Rav Moshe Shatskis. Oh, wow. By the way, part of the Chesped on Rav Moshe Shatskis is written up by Rav Heschel Shechter, by Rav Tzvi Shechter in Nefesh HaRav. In his first volume, he writes up part of that Chesped. And the Kovna, the final farewell in Slabatki Yeshiva on Yom Kippur, and then Eretz Yisrael, the Strauss courtyard in the Old City. Old timers can show you exactly where that courtyard was located, and that's where the Missa Trust owned quite a bit of property that they could make available to their Rabbanim, to their people, when they came in Aliyah. I just want... Yeah. It's not Nefesh HaRav. It's the Nishmat HaRav. It's the second one where he put in a whole section in Yiddish. I'll tell you what my theory is. Rav Aaron Ben Sion Shurin wrote this in Yiddish originally. Rav Shurin bothered him to publish it. There was no time and no one to translate it into Hebrew. Rav Shurin should have translated, but he's a man in his 90s. It might have been already, you know, you grow old. It's beyond your capabilities. So Rav Heschel did a chesed and published it. That's the answer. How many people read it? If we don't read it, we already read Yiddish, but I agree with you. I read Yiddish haltingly, so it's not worth it to me to put that effort in if I could see it in Hebrew, hear it on a tape, whatever it is. But I agree with you. It should have been translated, but you know what Rabbi Heschel will answer. My neighbor, Sam Dershowitz, wrote to him a whole critique of Nefesh HaRav with many corrections, emendations, and suggestions, and he answers him very simply. Lichvol Dr. Shmuel Hershowitz, Shalom Brachaki, I got your letter. I would advise you to write your own Sefer, and that way you can express your opinions. And that's it. Gentlemen, very important freebies. Let me get anyone want today's Yediyot Achronot? Rabbi Rubin brought in an extra copy. Anyone who wants it, take it. Anyone who's into Kabbalah, the Ketoret with Zohar HaKodesh. Anyone who's going to teach in Israel, me the Chodesh B'chadsho, you need this. It tells you about the month, everything happening in it, things to do with kids. Very valuable set. Edited by my student. This is an American Olah who edits this for the Israeli government. Aryeh Weinberger. Anyone wants two CDs by a Rabbi Raymond Bedya from the Sfada community? It's unbelievably... What's his name? How do you pronounce it? Beda? I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce it. In English. It's from Flatbush. It gives you the mentality of the Flatbush community, the money, the restaurants, their values. You will enjoy it. Anyone interested? This is Friday's Jerusalem Post. Kabbalah goes to yeshiva. One second. The most important, this you have to hear. Gentlemen, we have to make a Shechiyanu. What did Aaron Rakefet say months ago? It's on tape. He cannot understand why Rabbi Slifkin is under such heavy attack. Gentlemen, believe it or not, for the first time in history, there has been a break in the Agudat Yisrael world. And in the latest issue, February 2006, of Jewish Observer, there is a two-page article by someone who teaches right next door, Professor Leo Levy, coming out
Why did you attack Rabbi Slifkin? There's nothing he said that Gedolei Yisrael have not said. And it's unbelievable. You got to see how this is written. Slifkin's name is not there. The names that are Rabbanim in Israel is not there. But oh, is it obvious what they're talking about. And here is the commentary on, attached is the Jewish Observer by Rabbi Dr. Leo Levy. Here you are good at Gedolim, wrong about Slifkin Ben, guilty of sinat chinam and arrogance. And, oh my, goes on and on, Rav Herzog and all the sources. Now, to Rosh Yeshiva and a Mashkiach. This is a printout of the talks and Rabbi Przanski Shul. I have to tell you, you don't realize, that the counter reaction to inviting those three Gedolim for the right wing world, it's unbelievable. I'm getting call after call. What's my opinion? My opinion? I would love to hear these guys speak, but I would ask them questions. Oh boy. And you wouldn't be able to double talk me. Oh boy, when I left the bed, been there, I would have asked questions, but all right, that's the way life is. Gentlemen, the conservative movement, the New York Times, conservative Jews considering ending a ban on same-sex unions and gay rabbis. Anyone interested to know what's going on in Broadway and 122nd Street? Here's another copy. And finally, this was sent to me from America. Gershon printed it out. Very interesting. An interview with Professor Asa Kasha. You know who he is? That's the grandson of Rav Menachem Kasha, and the interview is on the Rocket Shava. Anyone interested, you're welcome. Now, next week, listen carefully. Sunday, there is no class. It is the Chag HaSmicha. Monday, I am giving I'm having what I call a press conference, Hashkafa. I'm talking about smicha, about the rabbinate, about our problems, about our responsibility, about Memori Chazal. What I don't say Sunday, because I have too much prepared for Sunday, and I have a little time slot, I'll say Monday with a lot more. So Be'ezrat Hashem, next week is devoted to the Chag HaSmicha. Now anyone who takes my picture on Thursday, I will punch them in the nose, because I'm going to be wearing a gown, I'm going to be wearing a tie, I'm going to look like an idiot. But in Rome, one has to do as the Romans, and I've been informed that this is a serious academic procession. Without the faculty wearing the gowns and the ties, the honorary degrees have no chalai shame. So I have to go along with Howard Weisband's request. I want to tell you that one of the people getting an honorary degree, you should know, it's a real chesed, Victor Geller, is a man of 80, worked for yeshiva, never got acknowledgement, did a beautiful memoir under Dr. Belkin era, a guy named Rakefet, was mice and nefesh to get it published. And I want to tell you, I am thrilled that they're giving him an honorary doctorate. The other people I know, I have my problems with some of them. Malkabin, I certainly have no problem with. Now,